Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Two of my favorite books of the last, I guess it's 10 years, maybe 12 years, the SNL Oral History and ESPN Oral History, both written by James Andrew Miller. He has a new book out now about CAA. Powerhouse, it's called. It's on, already on top, I think, of the bestseller list. Talked to us for about 40 minutes, a lot about the CAA book, which I really liked. But he got into ESPN as well, and there's a lot of stuff to pick through there as well. Good conversation with James Andrew Miller.
Your first book you wrote was the Senate book, is that correct?
Correct.
And I apologize. I read the SNL book, loved it. Read the ESPN book, loved it. And just finished this. I blew through this book. This is right in my wheelhouse. Loved it. I apologize. I haven't read that book. Is that book also in oral history format, or is it not?
No, and you're forgiven. I wrote it when I was a baby, and yeah. It was not the oral history format.
What is appeal to you? When did it first trigger for you when you're doing SNL, when you're researching it, to say, you know what, let's make this oral history, which has become, I think, more popular and is such a readable format. You know, it's like candy. Is it because of the size of personalities you're dealing with, say, in an SNL book?
You know, it's an interesting question. I love the oral history format, and I think that one of the things that I realized with Live from New York was that you're dealing with these people who are just so unique. When you talk to Bill Murray, when you talk to Tina Fey, Will Ferrell, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I'm sorry, but put Hemingway in front of a keyboard, and he won't be able to capture them in a way that they can reveal themselves to the readers, and I know there are people, you know, who say sometimes, oh, well, oral history, you know, the writer is not making up their, you know, I'm not making up their mind for the reader.
It seems like that's what James Stewart was saying in the review I read in the Times. Yeah.
But that's okay, man. It's like, don't go to a Japanese restaurant and order matzo ball soup.
This is
some oral history. This is what I do. I like it. I think that the transparency between, you know, the people who are speaking, and the way that they reveal themselves, and the way that they even, I swear to God, even in the way they form sentences, even in the way they tell stories. I mean, for the ESPN book, like, I sit down with Chris Berman, the first thing he says to me is, I was born on, John Wilkes Booth's birthday. Like, who, like, I mean, it's such an interesting way to talk. And, I mean, for Bill Murray to talk about the last time he saw Gilda Radner, and for, you know, Stuart Scott to talk about how he got, I mean, all these things that have happened in the books, and particularly this one, because this one was by far the hardest. So to have these people talking directly, particularly agents who aren't supposed to be talking about themselves, you know, they're supposed to be talking about the clients, I love oral history.
Oh, so do I. But was there part of you when you started tackling this book where it's easy to write about Bill Murray and have Bill Murray talk oral history, or Aykroyd, or Lorne Michaels, or Dan Patrick, or Olbermann, or all these characters from the first two books, or the last two books, Simmons? We know all these people. There are so many different agents who I knew a little bit about CAA through the stuff that had been written in the 80s, and obviously the Stewart book, and then Treat Williams in the late shift. But a lot of these characters I don't know. So is it then hard to introduce them that way? Because then I'm reading people, I'm not sure who they are. Does that make sense?
Right. Hey, you know what? I totally get it. Here's the deal, which is that I wanted, in addition to all the celebrities in the book,
right,
and, you know, people that you may, you know, know just from, because they were oversized personalities, like, and they're moguls, and like David Geffen and Michael Eisner and this one and that one, they're all in there. But I think when it came down to the agents, here's a job that a lot of people don't understand, mm-hmm, and they rarely talk about themselves. So if I'm writing a book about Hollywood over the past 40 years, which ostensibly this book is, I felt like it was my obligation almost to talk to these agents and to capture what they're like as well. And, you know, I've been really pleased since the book came out that people said, like, I really didn't know what they did, or I didn't know what kind of person they are. And, you know, some people think that agents are just these guys in black suits, and literally just guys who beat the crap out of people and get a good deal and, you know, call their client and brag. It's much more nuanced than that. It's much more evolved than that. And as a result, you know, I think that we're trying to, like, peel back the onion in a whole different culture.
First of all, it's a great book. Powerhouse is a great book, and I'm fascinated. Oh. The star of the book is obviously Ovitz. I mean, there's no way around it. And like I said, I first became aware of Ovitz, probably like most people do with all this stuff, was the Bill Carter book and then the TV movie, like I said, with Treat Williams playing him. I couldn't figure out reading it, and I guess that's maybe to your credit. I don't know. If you like Ovitz or if you don't like Ovitz, when I'm reading it, because there's so many, the story to me that's almost most interesting about Ovitz in a way is, and I apologize, is the agent who first tells a story about having Zemeckis direct Back to the Future 3, and then Ovitz tells the next story, and they are in complete contrast, their memory of the situation. So I'm wondering, is Ovitz a guy who is just comfortable lying, not telling the truth?
I don't think he's comfortable lying. I don't even think he thinks he's lying if he's saying something that's at odds with somebody else. I mean, for me as a writer, he's an unbelievable character to capture in a book. First of all, he's not somebody who typically cooperates, so
right.
I was really, really pleased. I mean, you know, if you're going to do a 40-year history of Hollywood and CA in particular, you know, I would say Michael Ovitz is probably, you know, one of the necessities. And I was, you know, prepared to do it without his cooperation, but I was really glad he did. I mean, look, he is, you know, those surveys that say 99 out of 100 people said, well, he's that 100th. He's the outlier. He's the guy who, you know, everybody says vanilla and he's the guy who says chocolate. So as a result, there is just a different way of looking at things. There's just constantly a different... It's almost like, you know, the whole world's a, you know, a PC, and he's a Mac. Like, he's speaking a different language for good and for bad. And I think that as a result, particularly his story was so Shakespearean, you know, I couldn't resist having him in the book.
Well, I mean, the way he crashed is kind of unbelievable. I mean, you could easily make the case the most powerful guy. I mean, he was ranked number one a couple of times in these polls in Hollywood for, you know, almost a decade. And then it all kind of ended in this flash, and then he sort of disappeared from public eye.
So how cool is it, though, this idea? I mentioned in the preface that, you know, somebody who is a really good agent for people like Robert Redford and Paul Newman and, you know, unbelievable, Tom Cruise and Martin Scorsese, and is like a lousy agent for himself.
Right.
And I think that that's like, you know, one of those, again, delicious kind of threads running through this book, which is that these people spend their days taking care of other people. And when it comes to taking care of themselves, they sometimes are not up to the challenge. They're not equal to the challenge. And I think that one of the things that happened to Michael Ovitz after he left CA in 1995 was that he was so aware of certain things and so unaware of other things, particularly, you know, on his own schedule, on his own compass, that it made for a really, really difficult post-CA world for him.
What's kind of incredible is, you know, is somebody who grew up in the 80s. I was a kid growing up in the 80s. And my favorite movies, if you know, ask me to list four or five of them, you know, Rayman would be on that list for sure. Ghostbusters would be on the list for sure. Tootsie would be on that list for sure. These are the movies that would not have happened without CAA. I mean, so that's, I think, maybe that's, I'm speaking for you here, but when you sat down and you started thinking about your next book subject, just the power of what CAA was able to do, just starting in movies, first of all, but then broadening out, that must have been a factor, because it's kind of an untold story about a place that was incredibly powerful for, you know, years and years and years, continues to be.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, the short version was, everybody knows what the initials SNL mean. Everybody knows what ESPN, they're worldwide. And what I wanted to do this time with CA is I wanted to kind of, like, outside of Hollywood, introduce a brand to people and to say to them, look, these three initials, you may not know them, but they're part of your world much more than you realize. Like, just like you're saying, from your favorite movies to ER, to like all these unbelievable TV shows, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Katy Perry and One Direction, and even like the Coca-Cola polar bear commercials.
Right. Chipotle and...
Yeah, it's crazy.
But was there part of you, the ESPN book was number one, New York Times bestseller. Was there part of you going in that was worried, what if I write this book? It could be great, but some people, there's a certain group that just won't give a shit. I mean, people care about ESPN. People care about SNL. They might not care about a bunch of agents. Was that ever a fear?
I think that what I said to my agent mm-hmm. when I told him I wanted to do this book is, look, you know, this is not going to jump out to number one because outside of Hollywood, you know, people may not know it, but it's okay because I want to tell the story anyway. I can't, you know, it's very hard to spend 3 years, and I interviewed over 500 people, you know, doing something and just thinking about, okay, is this going to be number one? Or is, I mean, I was thrilled that, you know, in its first week, it hit the New York Times bestseller list. And, you know, quite frankly, that was, you know, that's a blessing as far as I'm concerned. I'm enormously grateful. You know, whether it's number one or number 10 or number whatever, I mean, that's not really the goal of this book. The goal was to really kind of jump into the deep end of the pool of Hollywood and to give people an idea of, you know, what's been going on in Hollywood over the last 40 years through the prism of CA, and to capture what goes on behind the curtain. So people, you know, in Kansas and Florida and everything else have a sense of, you know, of what it's like. And by the way, why they should care about it, why it matters to them.
I could be wrong about this. Maybe you can correct me if you know it. I don't think I've ever seen Tom Cruise quoted in a book before. I could be wrong. But you talked to him, you know, semi-extensively. I guess two questions. One is, how does Jim Miller sit down with Tom Cruise or talk to him on the phone? Number two, how long was that conversation? Was it 45 minutes? Was it a couple of times? How does that work?
Look, I think I've been told at least that you're right in terms of Tom not cooperating with a book before. I think that one of the things that happens is, you know, people, and this was true with other celebrities, they may be fans of the other books or know something, maybe root for Vanity Fair or New York Times, and there's an element of trust. I think when they hear other people who are cooperating, that is further wind at my back. I mean, I was hoping to see Tom in person, and it kind of, you know, there was some months that went by, and finally, look, I mean, we wound up talking on the phone, I think, a couple times, and it just, I'm happy to get him on the phone if that's, you know, I'd rather have the bird in the hand mm-hmm. rather than keep on waiting for that moment to sit down, because it may never come with somebody like that. I mean, I, you know, I do most of my interviews in person, but I was just thrilled, you know, that he gave me, you know, the time that he did. And it's kind of interesting, right? I mean, he's crashing on Sean Penn's couch when he's 19.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, Sean Penn says, you got to check these people out at CA. So, I was much appreciated.
Well, you don't think of it. I'm a kid, or now when I'm watching, I don't think of it. You think a movie like Rain Man just shows up fully formed and arrived, but it's supposed to be Sidney Pollack directing. Levinson kind of maneuvers his way in with Ovitz. And Paula Wagner, who is Cruise's agent forever, says originally it's supposed to be Hoffman and Nicholson. Paula Wagner says, well, wait a minute. Let's have Cruise be, you know, so CAA plays a massive role. Rain Man does not happen without CAA.
Rain Man doesn't happen. There's tons of other movies that don't happen. There's tons of, I mean, literally, I loved the idea when I found out. And he just thought, you know, ER is like a movie script sitting in a CAA script vault until a CAA agent pulls it out and starts reading it and says, wait a second, what about a TV show out of this? I mean, on and on and on and on and on. And, I mean, it was just, I met with Mick Fleetwood, and, you know, they were at ICM, another agency, and when their agent Tom Ross came over to see it, he's like, "Of course we're going to come, man. The guy let us rehearse when we had no money in the ICM basement. he was the one who pushed us to, you know, hire and support us when we wanted to hire Lindsay and Christine McVay. I mean, it's like, it's just these great stories that, I don't know, just, you know, I try and be a fan too, you know, a reader too, mm-hmm. when I'm doing these books. Like, what is, you know, what's blown me away? What's interesting and new? And it was just a lot of fun.
It's interesting you mentioned this earlier. So you would have been willing to go forward and write an oral history CAA book if you had had zero cooperation from Ovitz. That seems to be, that's almost like writing an SNL book without Lorne Michaels talking. It seems difficult to do.
I'll give you one better than that, just to show you how reckless and suicidal I can be. I signed the deal without even telling CAA.
Jesus.
And as a result, they, when I told them, they said, well, we're not going to cooperate. We don't cooperate with books. And we wish, we wish you had asked us beforehand, before signing that contract, because it's not going to happen. Now, I was really pleased that they changed their mind and they did cooperate, because they had never cooperated before. But I have to tell you, I'm not saying, look, I'm not saving the world here or curing cancer, but it is a weird thing to put your signature on a contract, that's going to be a very visible book, and you have no idea if anybody is going to talk to you. And the only thing you really know is that people like Ovitz and places and CA itself have notoriously said no. So yeah, I guess it was a kind of a big roll of the dice for somebody who has three kids.
When you sit down with a guy like Ovitz, and I'm sure you spent a lot of time with him, seems like you did you feel like he was trying to manipulate you at all? Did you feel like he was trying to charm you, do what he did over the years to so many people?
Yeah, we spent 2.5 years together. And look, once an agent, always an agent. I mean, do I think that he had an agenda? Sure. I think his agenda was, if a book that is going to be written about the history of a company that I co-founded, I wanted to match my version of reality as much as possible. And I think he was incredibly respectful, though, of my process, because, he didn't ask to read what others were saying. I did church and state. I kind of separated that. There was a wall between that. It wasn't like I was running to him every time and saying, oh my gosh, Billy Smith just said this about you. What do you think about that? That's not the way I operate. And he was very respectful of that, because I'm sure he was, damn curious. But these books take on kind of lives of their own, and each one is a different kind of journey. This one was by far the most difficult, but in some ways, I love them all, but I'm saying in some ways it's the most gratifying, because it really was the highest bar to jump over.
Well, it seems like it would be like the ESPN book. If you write the ESPN book, it seems like it's kind of easy to format, even in oral history format. You kind of know the beginning, you know the middle, you know the end. SNL, it's really easy, kind of year by year by year by year. I was thinking of this when I was reading your book. It must be tougher when you're editing the oral history part, making things work, sort of having a linear form. It must be difficult to figure out which spot goes where when you're doing this book. I would think, I could be wrong, the most difficult of any of the three books from that aspect.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. In fact, to your point, I do an outline before each book, and the outline for the SNL book that I did beforehand kind of mirrored what came out. And in ESPN, there were a few, important detours that I had to do as my reporting uncovered more things, and I had to get into this and that and this that I didn't anticipate, because quite frankly, it had never been reported before, so I really had to, like, once I found it, I couldn't have known it beforehand. With the CA book, I was constantly redoing the outline. And in fact, truth be told, during the last year, I basically gave up on the outline. I had to go where I thought I had to go. And, particularly like with something like CA Sports, which, through my reporting, I was able to report that in 2015, CA Sports made more money than CA Movies.
That's wild. That is wild.
I mean, I could not. By the way, there were people in the building who didn't know that.
Yeah, that's
the competition.
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Right. So all of a sudden, once I start to realize this, I think to myself, well, I'm going to have to spend a little bit more time on CA Sports than I realized, because I have to explain how this came to happen. I have to trace the pedigree of that enormous growth, and I have to explain the kind of business they were building. So, you know, things like that happen. And, I mean, look, it's fun. I mean, particularly when you're, you know, discovering new things and you're reporting things that hadn't been reported before, and you're getting people like, you know, the private equity guys who now basically have a controlling interest in CA to talk, because they're not, you know, particularly fond of talking. So all that was part of the journey.
You know, when you read these books, these oral history books, even the last 3 years, you can always line up the ones, the guys who look better and the women look better and look worse coming out of the book. For me, one of the big surprises, and again, as a child of the 80s and 90s, I love this guy, is Stallone. Stallone comes across great in this book.
Oh, my God, I'm so glad you said that, because guess what? I was asked the other day, I was on TV, like, you know, what were one of the, you know, best surprises? I was like, Sylvester Stallone. I mean, first of all, people forget that this guy, aside from Muhammad Ali, was the biggest thing on the planet.
Well, you tell the story in the book about where you're in Kenya.
Ron Meyer tells the story about being like in Thailand,
right.
You know, Rambo 2 locations, and they're walking along this riverbank in the middle of nowhere. There's not a TV, there's no any culture in sight, and people on the other side of the river are chanting Rocky, Rocky, Rocky. I mean, Ron said when he would go out to dinner with Stallone, sometimes, you know, the blocks would be closed. I mean, when they came out.
Well, in the summer, you know, back then, you write up, you know, you have, I think Joel Silver's talking about it. Back in the summer in the 80s, it was, okay, here's a block in the summer in 83 for Sly, in 84, in 85, in 86, and you were done.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, he was the first one. I think he and Schwarzenegger were the first guys to do it. But you can't have it's one of the misperceptions about Stallone, because he got famous for playing kind of a marble mouth sort of boxing dummy. You can't have the kind of career he's had for 40 years, still be a star and not be smart. I don't think it's possible.
But wait a second. How about the idea that when I asked him about what it was like when Ron
called the poem,
you know, he said, I'm going to go to Universal. Like, that, he tells me how they both wound up crying, and then afterwards he wrote Ron a poem.
I mean,
seriously, if you were a studio chief and I wrote that in a screenplay and I gave it to you, you'd come back to me, you go,
toss
Jim,
it.
Come on. Like, you're pushing it a little bit too much.
Right.
Okay? You're just putting, come on, Sylvester Stallone writing a poem, let's cut it out.
You talked to Cruz, Stallone, Kidman, Jennifer Lopez, Sarah Jessica Parker. I mean, a whole bunch of, you know, Hanks. Was there a star or a star or two that you weren't able to land that you thought were essential to put this book together? Was there one guy you said, shit, I really wish I was able to land that guy, from a star perspective?
Not really.
No?
I mean, I think it was more about that I would have loved to have interviewed Mike Nichols and Paul Newman, both of whom were deceased. I think more of that was more.
You didn't talk to Redford, right?
No, I didn't talk to Redford.
You tried?
And I think, you know, I have a lot of respect for Robert Redford, and I talked to several people close to him, and that was one of those decisions where I like literally did not even do a request, because by the time I heard from several people close to him that just that era and, you know, that what he went through with
Ovitz.
Those years there was just something that he really, really didn't want to talk about. So I didn't want to, I wanted to respect him and respect that and not put him in that kind of position. You know, that said, when I got together with Barbara Streisand, she was like, I don't like talking to her. I was like, come on, give me a couple. Like, and she was terrific. You know, I mean, she was, I only wish I could have parenthetically included her, like, mannerisms and her facial expressions and her hand gestures and stuff like that, because she's, She really is amazing.
What is your? I'll just transition here quick as we let you go. I mean, you wrote the ESPN book. We do a lot of sports media stuff on our show. What is your thought right now on the current state of ESPN? It's funny, we're doing the radio show this morning, and I'm watching as I do, you know, without sound. And it seems to me now what SportsCenter continues to try to do
is build these personalities who really aren't funny, these personalities. They're trying to do what they did 20 years ago, and it's just not working. Something just seems forced right now, and I'm watching SportsCenter, for example, particularly in the morning.
Well, you know, the problem is that a lot of it isn't news to you.
True,
I mean,
that's true.
If you're like me, I mean, I'm getting everything on my phone as soon as I wake up. I'm getting scores after every three innings of my favorite baseball teams on my phone. I can watch the highlights on my phone. So it's value proposition to you and to many others is so different. You know, when I was writing the ESPN book and I was really drilling down like on the Dan and Keith days, and do you know that they used to go to a commercial and say, when we come back, we're going to tell you what happened with the Giants and the Padres last night, you know, tonight. It's like, can you imagine that now?
No,
it's
right. You'd be watching the highlight with Kilbourne doing a, you know, a Warriors Kings highlight, and you had some suspense. You're like, well, who won this game?
Oh,
it was a mystery.
It's fantastic. But there's no suspense.
But
there's
no suspense anymore. I do feel like they, and when you get older, maybe you do this, but I'm watching ESPN today in the morning and at night, and I don't see Patrick's and Olbermann's and Kilbourne's and Eisen's. I don't see those, that next generation breaking out like this generation did. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, they're not trying to do it, which I think, you know, quite frankly, look, there's a lot of smart people over there, but I personally think that the way that we had the personalities, even Bob Lee and Charlie Steiner and Robin Roberts at 6:30 and Keith and Dan, obviously, and Craig and Eisen and all those people that you just mentioned. You know, I think that the SportsCenter should be almost like Jimmy Fallon in the sense that there's a personality that you want to hang out with, and you're going to get the scores, and you know, but you'll also get really great analysis that you can't maybe get on your phone. And that personality is someone you want to hang out with. I mean, what Jon Stewart did for politics, there's got to be a Jon Stewart out there who can do that for sports and with sports. And, you know, if you do that, I think people are going to watch. But if it's people that you don't particularly know and don't have any outsized personalities and they're delivering information that you already know, then I'm not sure that that's compelling enough in today's, you know, world with so many different options.
Is there a chance that ESPN, and this is kind of my theory on this, ESPN says, you know what, that's a good idea, Jim. That's not a bad idea. But you know what, we'd rather just kind of keep it safe, stay in the fairway, and you know what, we might lose a couple of subscribers a year. It's true, we're losing a little bit of money. But the average fan, because, you know, as you know, in New England, people are so bullshit at ESPN over the whole Deflategate thing. But argument's been the whole time, well, you're going to watch Monday Night Football? You're going to watch the Masters? You're going to watch the Rose Bowl? Of course you are. ESPN's not going to go. They're not going to go anywhere. It's going to continue to be a complete cash cow.
Oh yeah. Well, listen, that's a whole different thing. Now we're conflating, you know, one of the things that John Skipper did really, really well.
Live TV, right?
Live TV, yeah. With you know, programming TV like SportsCenter, and they got, when it comes to live TV, they got a pretty big moat.
Yeah, it's insane. And the money they're still spending on these things. Although, if you look at it now, and I think I might have read, you maybe tweeted this somewhere else, all their deals right now are they're signed up forever for all these guys. I mean, they got Monday Night Football, they have baseball, they have the Rose Bowl, they have all these things lined up for the next 6-7 years.
Yes. I mean, he went on a huge spending spree. And, you know, quite frankly, it's almost impossible to think of, you know, a way of, like, literally going toe-to-toe with them and trying to win. I think that, you know, NBC and other, they figured out that they don't necessarily have to go toe-to-toe to win, i.e. make money and still have a thriving, you know, a thriving sports enterprise.
What is your take? I know you like him. I heard you on this podcast a couple of days ago, and you've written about him a lot. What's your take so far on Simmons' TV show and The Ringer?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm very, I did not review it, you know, right away. I'm a big builder. I'm a big belief in building things and giving people a chance to, you know, get settled. And, I mean, one of the things that I can tell from the TV show already is that they're, you know, figuring things out and trying to see what really works for them, let alone the viewer. The Ringer, you know, there's just a bunch of really, really talented people there. I mean, they didn't have the ESPN platform to launch it. I mean, Bill's name is pretty damn big, though. So, I mean, you can't bet against him.
Do you think in our in my lifetime, say, the next 20 years, do you think you're ever going to see a viable challenger at ESPN? Fox Sports One, it's not going to happen. I think we know that. CNN tried years ago. It didn't work. Is ESPN just too big that it'll never be challenged? I mean, legitimately challenged.
Well, see, I guess that's what I mean, which is what does challenge mean? Because if you're just trying to create, you know, another sports entity that has probably a $50 billion valuation to it, then, you know, forget it.
Well, challenges this. Challenges say, like, so I do a morning talk, a sports talk show here at EEI in Boston. A challenge would be, instead of ESPN being the default thing when I walk in the morning, or the default thing at the gym, or when I go home to flip on SportsCenter, to have that second option in my head. To me, you know, Fox Sports 1, in 3 years, I think it's been around now, has not presented that alternative yet.
No.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that, I mean, look, though, I mean, NBC had it with the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, they have it every 2 years with the Olympics. And I think that they have it on Sunday night. I think Fox has it and CBS has it on Sunday morning. I just on a daily thing. I mean, look, obviously it's one of the things Jamie Horowitz is trying to engineer now, bringing Skip Bayless over and others to have that kind of provocative conversations in the morning. So you turn on the, you know, TV in the morning and you're going to turn into Fox. I mean, look, if he's successful with that, then that will happen, only because I don't think ESPN right now is going to, outside of, you know, Stephen A. and Max, you know, they don't have a lot to combat that. It's just a question of whether he can be as successful with it over there. And, God, given the money that is at stake, it's a pretty interesting thing to watch.
You know, it's pretty wild. As you wrote the SNL book, which was great. Actually, it's my favorite one, your three books. I liked all three, but I love the SNL one. The ESPN one, like I said, I really enjoyed too. You could almost write, and maybe you will, you could almost write new complete books. I know. I think you updated the SNL one, but you could almost write new complete books about where you left off at the end of those two books to today.
Yes, that's actually true.
I mean, there's been so much drama at both places, particularly I think at ESPN. You could write 400 pages today on the last 3 years of ESPN.
I think that's very true.
Am I giving you a? Is this sound familiar to you? This idea or no?
Yes, a lot of people
okay.
are.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Have been.
Is that next? Is that next for you or no?
You know, I can't really talk about it right now, but yeah. There's always something going on.
How about for a quick SNL question? And I don't know if you still talk to him, if you deal with him at all. How much longer do you think Lorne Michaels keeps doing this?
Let's see. What's forever?
Really?
I don't know, call me crazy, but I can't imagine the day when, like, Lauren just says, forget it. I don't know. I don't see it. I mean, Lord willing, he stays healthy, and, you know, he's certainly vibrant, and I don't think there's anybody out there right now, or has been for a while, that could take his place. Yeah, I don't know. I think that this is going to continue for quite a while.
You formed a pretty good relationship, at least through those two books, with Murray. It seems like you and Murray's another guy who never talks. You've gotten Murray to talk extensively now in two of these books.
He's the best. He's the best. I think I said to somebody the other day. I said, like, literally anywhere in the world, if you were having a wedding and you could pick one person to give the toast at your wedding. I don't even know who number two is. Bill Murray is like, you know, he's got to be the person that, you know, he's really unbelievable. And I feel really, really fortunate that, you know, he talked.
Well, the book is Powerhouse. It's a look at CA. It's a great book. Pick it up. It's doing fantastic. I'm not surprised to hear that. Jim, I really appreciate you taking some time out here to talk about it. And good luck. And good luck with the next book, which I hope we'll be hearing about soon.
Hey, thanks, man.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim. All right, thanks as always for listening to the Enough About Me podcast. If you want more podcasts like this with guests like Artie Lang, who else is going to have Artie Lang and fucking Bob Ryan on the same podcast, or David Portnoy and John Tomasi? If you want to listen to podcasts like this, you go to iTunes, Stitcher, you go to WEI.com, you go to the mobile app. When you go to iTunes, leave a rating, leave a review, and subscribe. That's going to help us out a lot. If you want more of these, leave a rating, leave a review, and subscribe. Make sure you do that for me. That is a command. Now do it.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.